And 70 years ago this week, the biggest airborne operation ever took place, the liberation of Holland. It was called Operation Market Garden, and its failure allowed Hitler an extra 6 months to bury his treasure, that is, the looted wealth of the whole of Europe, apart from Switzerland, of course, before the end of the war. So was Market Garden sabotaged by Nazi spies and Brits who wanted a share of Hitler's loot? Can't let a September the 11th slip by, as it did a couple of weeks ago, or a week or so ago, without comment. This was the 13th anniversary of the attack that supposedly changed the world. An attack that's still to this day not been properly investigated. We hear tonight from the former US Naval Intelligence Officer turned US radio talk show host who predicted the 9/11 attacks 2 whole months before they happened. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour, after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius, feeling humid, with some possibly thundery showers. This weekend, highs of 20, light cloud on Saturday with further possible thundery showers. Sunnier, though, on Sunday, and feeling fresher. Next week, highs of 20, plenty of sunny spells during the week. Next weekend is the 27th, 28th of September, highs of 16 with sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news, it's the Green MEP for South West of England, Molly Scott-Cato. Hi, Molly, and welcome to The Politics Show.
Hello, nice to be here.
First of all, how long have you now been an MEP?
Well, the elections were on, the counting was on the 26th of May, but I was sort of enshrined or enthroned or whatever it is that happens on the 1st of July.
And tell us, what do they actually do at the European Parliament? Do they introduce you to how it all works? And because many of us, it's a complete mystery how it all works.
It is rather mysterious. Like anything as huge as that, it's quite hard to work out what goes on. But we're supported by lots of staff who've worked there before, so they kind of understand the procedures, and that helps a lot.
So just explain, because for a lot of us, me included, including most of our audience, there's this kind of massive thing in Strasbourg and Brussels where everyone gets together, but they kind of really only have the chance, you, not to really write legislation, but you do have the chance to stop it sometimes. So just to explain how the process works of the European Parliament.
Okay, well, one of the things I'm hoping to do is to help people understand, as I learn myself, about how it all does work in terms of making law. And my website, mollymep.org.uk, is going to have stuff about what I'm doing, but also about how the Parliament works. So really, there's, as you say, the legislation starts with the Commission in almost all cases. There are three bodies: Commission, Council of Ministers, and Parliament. Most legislation starts with the Commission and then it comes to us, but we can amend it quite significantly. Different types of law, we have different amounts of power. So the TTIP trade treaty that people are now getting quite concerned about, we can only say yes or no at the end of the day to that, because the Parliament doesn't have very much power in the area of trade. But with something like fisheries policy, we're kind of making that jointly with the Commission, so we have a lot more power there. And so most of my time is taken up, I'm on the Economics Committee, so most of my time is taken up looking at detailed proposals for legislation, say how to control the banks and how much capital banks have to hold would be an example. And we then have to debate that with the other political groups and seek to amend what the Commission sends us.
Okay, it's lovely putting it in a nutshell like that. But let's start with the Commission, because they're not elected, are they? How? Who decides who's going to be a European Commissioner? I mean, you would hope in a democracy, if Europe, EU is a democracy, that they would be elected directly.
So this is an interesting question, to what extent the European Union is democratic. I mean, it's not a nation state, so it doesn't have direct democracy like a nation state would, because what we're doing is trying to have cooperation between the 28 member states. And the reason we try to do that is because prior to the European Union existing, there were wars across the continent. And my reason for getting involved is I want to preserve that, because I think it's worth it, even though I acknowledge there are a lot of problems. So if you think about 28 completely different member states trying to agree stuff, it does take quite a long time. And the sort of, if the Parliament had all the power, it would start alienating some states, because we all have very different local political systems. So rather than the Parliament deciding what happens, there are three bodies. One is the Council of Ministers, and that one is the heads of state or the finance ministers or whoever from the member states. So if it was foreign policy, the 28 foreign secretaries would all get together and talk about Ukraine, for example. But as you say, the commission is the most worrying part, because the commission is effectively a civil service. They haven't been elected by anybody. And so some of the stuff they propose, I know perfectly well that if I tried to sell that to people in the Southwest, they would just laugh me off the face of the earth.
Give us an example.
Oh, what is an example of that?
Because it's Van Rompuy, I think, is in charge, isn't he? And people talk about him as the president of Europe. But it's rather worrying where we've got a system where people are starting to talk about the president of Europe, but the guy hasn't actually been elected.
No, he isn't. He's on his way out now. It's going to be Jean-Claude Juncker.
That's right.
He's on the way in. But he isn't the president of Europe. He's actually the president of the commission. And so it would just be a mistake to call him the president of Europe. But that's not to say the commission isn't powerful, because it is. And I agree with you that it's not democratic, and the Parliament should have more power and the Commission less.
I mean, this Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the TTIP, for example, is this kind of buzzword going around the internet. And I've seen quite a lot of very good articles in some of our mainstream newspapers, the broadsheet press, about it. Basically, what they're trying to do is to bring in a kind of legal welding together of the US and the EU, so that big corporations can actually sue national governments if they bring in legislation which hurts their profits. Now, in a way, that's basically the old question, isn't it? Is who's in charge here?
Yeah.
And it looks to me as if what they're saying is actually big corporations should be in charge, not our elected politicians.
I totally agree, and the Green Group agrees with that as well. And I tried to raise this as an issue before and during the election campaign, but it was hard to get journalists interested.
How come the Commission and so many people across the EU seem to be behind it?
That's a good question. I mean, one of the things I was going to come to when talking about the Commission is that they're very much subjected to lobbying by corporations. You know, corporations employ lobbyists themselves. They have companies that lobby on their behalf. So the power of corporations over what comes out of Europe is much too dominant, and I think that's a lot of what goes wrong. And I mean, TTIP is a good example of something. I mean, I've argued, you know, in the Western Mail, for example, that the Western Morning News, that it's going to be bad for farmers, because it's not actually melding the legal systems of Europe and the US, but it is making a single market. So the sort of regulations that you have over, say, animal welfare will have to be the same on both sides of the Atlantic. So the sort of higher standards that we've got here, you know, we don't have hormone in our beef, for example, we'll now have to compete with US beef. Now, some people argue, oh, well, you know, American standards might rise, but I mean, I can't see why they would get involved if that was the case. And also, we don't know about that because the negotiations are happening in secret. So that's another thing you think about the Commission proposal. I mean, if it was so
secret,
good for people...
Unelected? Secret? Yeah. This isn't democratic.
Well, if it was so good for people, why don't they let us know what's going on?
Good question.
It's very problematic.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, your views then, can we just have on the EU and how it all works? Because the idea is a great one. And Molly was talking there about the fact that there being these two world wars raging across Europe, the idea of actually having some kind of dialogue between countries, kind of federation, if you want. That was the idea. How has it all transpired? Is it working or not?
Well, it's been dominated, unfortunately, by vested interests like corporations and banks. And those who were opposed to EU integration in the first place, from the left, opposed it for those reasons. I think, in principle, the EU could be a counterweight to corporate power if the political side of it was strong enough. But, of course, it's a very rickety construct, and it's very easy for, you know, the round table of industrialists, for example, to dominate the Commission. And also this TTIP thing, we didn't even know about it until very recently.
Well, we did, actually. We knew about it for about a year, but the media weren't sort of...
A year? I mean, that's not very long, is
it?
That's not very long, a year, for a deal that's going to be, a major change in international trade policy. So we found out about a year ago. We still don't know what's in it. Mm. And when it comes out, you will get a chance to say, yay or nay to it, and that's it. I mean, that sounds to me like we're like a stitch-up from behind the scenes,
It's very problematic, I agree with you. And also, I don't know if you followed, but recently a lot of citizens across Europe were trying to get this thing going called a citizens' initiative, where they can actually engage as citizens in the lawmaking process. But the Commission has decided they're not going to allow that in the case of the TTIP. And, I mean, this past week, because the new commissioners are being appointed, and I've got some serious concerns about two in particular, you know, the banking guy, Lord Hill, who's Cameron's appointment, and also the climate change guy from Spain called Cañete. So I was looking into the law to see, you know, what you can actually do legally to stop these things happening, and the answer is extremely little. I mean, I think we kind of don't understand the benefit of our common law system sometimes, rather than the statute law they have in Europe. And in statute law, if something isn't there protecting you legally, then, you know, you're nowhere. Whereas in our countries, you actually can sort of make law up as you go along. Okay, you need the money to go there and you need to put the effort into to challenge something legally. But judicial review is a good example of that. I was thinking, well, what's the European equivalent of judicial review? Why can't we take the commissioner's choices to judicial review? But the answer is there isn't one. So, again, that is a disturbing aspect. As a citizen, what legal redress is there? Doesn't seem to be very much.
Maybe as a corporation there's quite a lot, and as a citizen not a lot. But anyway, Molly, before we go further into the economics of it all, the European Central Bank and that sort of thing, what brought you into politics? What's your background?
Well, just to say what brought me into the European Union, I mean, I agree that I used to think actually this is appalling sort of corporate behemoth and there's absolutely no point in getting involved. So I've been very Eurocritical, but over time I've changed my view and I now think that Europe is the only thing that can stand up against the corporations, although I'm not saying we're doing that effectively and it's very difficult to do. But I still think it's better to be trying to do that, because otherwise I don't see what power we have. But in terms of your wider question, I mean, I've been an environmentalist since, like, I don't know, half my life, 25 years or more, and I just worked on a lot of individual campaigns. I worked a lot on nuclear energy and nuclear power, and eventually it just sort of occurred to me that all these problems were coming from the same place, which was the way the economy was organised and the way, you know, the powerful forces in the economy. So I just decided to study economics and find out how that worked. And then eventually, when, you know, once I felt I understood it, try and get some political power to try and change it.
And do you think now you've had a little time at the European Parliament that that's the place to do it?
Actually, there are advantages in being an MEP. I mean, you're pretty well resourced. You know, I can have staff, I can organise my office, I can have access to all sorts of information resources that I think do make it easier to make change. The other side of it is that you're terribly focused on minute lawmaking, which probably you can't make a great deal of difference, especially because the Green Group is only 50 people. But I think what I have to do is not lose the focus on what's happening here. Just use the platform that I've got as an MEP. For example, today I can argue about the importance of devolving power to the regions because I'm an MEP. They'll now have me discussing that on local radio stations, whereas previously I wouldn't have had a platform. So I have to kind of use the platform I've got here in the Southwest and not just focus on lawmaking in Brussels.
But it sounds to me like the big corporations are in the driving seat over on the continent, and you're really, all you're able to do is kind of put your finger in the dike, even as an MEP.
Well, you know, you have to make a decision about where you can be most effective, and I think as Greens, what we do effectively is finding out about what's going on, understanding it and communicating it to the wider public. Because one of the things that does frighten the Commission is if there's a lot of citizen disquiet with what they're doing. So this is why they're now upset about TTIP. So that was the result of work by people like me and campaigning groups in Britain saying, look what's going on with TTIP, and you no doubt with your radio station as well. You know, look what's going on with TTIP. Now the Commission is getting a bit scared and they're trying to shut it all down. And I personally think we will get the ISDS, you know, the investment provisions out of TTIP. I'm not so optimistic about defeating the whole trade treaty, but if we get the ISDS out of there, then I think that's really worth doing.
Okay, Martin, what are your thoughts about TTIP and whether it's going to, I believe it's due to be signed and sealed at the end of the year?
Well, if there's a website that Molly may be aware of, got a LEAP 2020 website, they're a French think tank, a futurologist think tank, and their position on this is very clear, is that the crisis in the Ukraine has been manufactured by the US interests in order to prevent the natural economic development, the natural economic cooperation between Russia and particularly Germany, and to shepherd the European countries into TTIP. So we're talking about geopolitical machinations, really. And I think TTIP may fail precisely because there's not been international trade treaties passed in the last 10 or 15 years. They've started to fail from Seattle onwards. There's been too much objection I mean, when it comes out that TTIP, for example, is going to have all kinds of impacts on all sorts of different people, they won't be able to push it through without a huge...
Give us an example of how this is likely to impact, because, I mean, this is one of those things that most of us think of as miles away. This is something that's not going to affect our lives at all.
Well, if I was a Farageist, for example, I would find it really extraordinary that all of these rules and regulations in the EU, which everybody's up in arms about who decides them and how they're made, are just going to be completely rewritten by the US in one go. I mean, how extraordinary is that? I mean, we ought to, in fact, you know, if surely the mood in Europe is for more scrutiny of regulations and decisions coming from the centre, not bringing a whole load of new layer of bureaucracy based in Washington and on the top end.
OK, a bit of a devastating development over the last few weeks, Molly, is this idea of the European Central Bank actually starting to do this printing money, quantitative easing, they now call it. But I can remember, even as a youngster, anyone was saying, oh, you printing money is going to be a disaster. Tell us, what does it actually mean for the European Central Bank to have made this decision? I mean, is it really momentous, or was it bound to happen?
It's, I think, quite important to remember that it's not actually printing money. If it was printing money, that would be a lot better, because you'd actually get paper money coming out and people would have to spend it in the real economy. What we're talking about here is creating electronic money that goes to banks and never comes out into the real economy. So,
I mean, surely it will trickle out somehow.
Well, that doesn't seem to be happening, no. It's just staying with the banks and, you know, becoming part of their capital reserves and also presumably being paid to shareholders and
Martin,
bank
why
bonuses.
Is that? Why is this money, even though it's being created, put it into the banking system, it's not finding its way out into the real world?
Because there's a basic liquidity trap going on, which is there's not enough demand in the economy, real demand for real goods
and
services.
Can you explain that? What is a liquidity trap?
Well, you can reduce interest rates right to a very low level, even to effectively negative interest rates, but that doesn't necessarily make the economy pick up. Because if people fear for the future, if we get into deflation, this is why they're talking about having quantitative easing for the ECB, because of course the Germans have been rather resistant to it up to now, because there's a danger that they're going to fall into a deflationary liquidity trap, which means that people will hang on to money because they know that the price of everything is falling. So I'm not going to buy my new computer today, I'm going to buy it in a year's time or 6 months' time. And if everybody makes those decisions, it squeezes demand in the economy.
I suppose so, liquidity is the money that's slushing around in
the
economy.
Yes, the stuff stuck in the banking system is actually being used to keep asset prices higher than they otherwise would be. If there'd been no government intervention in the crash would have carried its way through and asset prices would have collapsed. And of course that's so what we've done is we've bailed out the property owners, those who own assets, rather than the ordinary population, which is, as has been suggested, would have been a much more sensible way to go forward.
Yeah, I think in the context of the European Central Bank, I mean, people probably remember, like, I think it was the summer before last, there were repeated crises, you know, with different countries not being able to finance their debt. And that only came to an end when the European Central Bank agreed to buy bonds from those countries. And that effectively was like a quantitative easing programme. Oh. But they dressed it up as something else because Germany had said it would never accept a quantitative easing programme. And actually it was illegal under the treaty that set up the euro as well. So they had to sort of send them through a secondary bank to make it look like it was legal. Anyway, now we're having... Because when they create money, what they do is buy a bond. So at that stage they were buying government bonds. But now they're buying all sorts of not quite junk bonds, but bonds that don't really have very much value. You know, toxic debt. This is the crazy thing about a bank, that assets are debt and debts are assets. So, you know, so the question is, what's the quality of the debt? And that's where the row is now. What sort of debts are they going to buy? So what we're proposing as a green group is that when they come to the market to buy bonds, they have to buy bonds that are associated either with small businesses or with green investment. So let's say you have a green investment bank and it issues bonds, then when they buy those, they're sending money directly into green investment. And we could do that. We could choose other things that we think it would be useful to fund, because otherwise all that happens is that money is kept in the finance sector. But if it was sent out to small businesses and green investment, then it would be doing some good. It would also be creating jobs, and it would be helping us move towards a green economy. So we're trying to work out a proposal that would achieve that. You know, so you're actually getting money out there into the real economy.
Martin, do you think that's going to work?
Well, I think the problem with it is that there have been promiscuous quantitative easing both in the US and Britain for many years now, for several years. I mean, it's become the new normal. If you remember when we started, this was going to go on for a few months until the crisis was over, and it's now become permanent. And I think that what probably happened is that they will be forced by the deflationary trap that they are in to just pile into the markets and buy anything just to keep the show on the road until the whole thing goes down. Because I'm afraid the reality is that once you've got into a situation like this, what is more than likely to happen is a follow-on crash.
Well, we have to get the debt out of the system, don't we? That's the project. I mean, Britain isn't doing quantitative easing now. I mean, the $375 billion was the extent of it. But, I mean, they haven't withdrawn that, so that money is supposed to still be out there. But it's not out there in the real economy. But, I mean, the real problem is just this, the massive level of public and private debt. And, you know, what they call the debt overhang. And the only way to get rid of that is to persuade somebody who's holding that debt, namely a creditor, to take a loss. And that's where the blockage is. And I completely agree with you. It makes the whole system very unstable.
So, Martin's banging on here week after week saying there is a real danger of a catastrophic crash, and the problem being that unlike, say, the 1929 crash, the government really hasn't got the resources to spend its way out of the resulting disaster.
Well, we didn't really have that financial crash last time, in the sense that the government came in with this created
money
to
stop that happening.
Yeah.
But I mean, talking about crashes rather like 1929, where it's really catastrophic.
Well, I mean, there's two things. There's a financial crash, and then there's the consequences for the real economy when money dries up. We have seen the consequences for the real economy of money drying up, and we're continuing to see that, particularly in the Eurozone, because there hasn't been quantitative easing. But we haven't, you know, they did stop the absolutely catastrophic failure of the financial system. But while you continue to hold enormous amounts of debt like this, then that is a risk. It's very unstable. And, I mean, coming back to Lord Hill, you know, Cameron's commissioner, his job as a commissioner is to ensure financial stability, and I really think that's just impossible to say you can do that unless you look at this question of debt. If people can't pay their debts, then you have to negotiate that. You can't just endlessly insist on them selling more stuff and just taxing people more and cutting public spending. There's no way of paying those debts ultimately, and that's because of the mistaken way that money's created in the first place.
Okay, so let's have your quick solution, the Green Party solution. What would you be doing, Molly, if you were in the driving seat?
Well, last September we did pass a policy of saying we should have directly created money rather than money created privately through banks based on debt.
You're nodding, Martin, yeah?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's the long-term solution. But the short-term solution in terms of negotiating this debt away is not so easy, because the people who would lose value if you started to say, you know, like Argentina defaulted 2001, people got, I think, 35% of the value of what they were holding. Now, if people even suspected that that might be happening, then the markets themselves can speculate against you and destabilise the system themselves. So this is why it's extremely difficult to make a move, to make a policy move, because you'd have to do it in secret. And we wouldn't like that, would we?
Well, I don't know. Why not? Why not do something over a weekend where you say, right, we're closing the markets
on
Friday. We're not necessarily going to open them on the Monday, but we're making some very big changes.
Well, so after 9/11, which you were also mentioning, the stock markets were closed for a week because they started plummeting because people lost confidence in the US. Mm. So, of course, that's right. I mean, we imagine the markets are in charge, but actually politicians can control those markets. They regulate them. They can close them. But, yeah, I mean, that's what we'd be looking at. We'd have to look at saying, this is an absolute emergency, or we're going to just renegotiate where we're at. And at the moment, everybody thinks they can just stagger along, and they're not going to reach that point.
But I'm glad you're saying the politicians are in charge of the markets, because I see my evidence seems to be the other way around.
Well,
the politicians have to dance to the tune of the
markets. They don't take charge of the markets, but like, let's think about a banking license. I mean, a bank cannot operate without a license, otherwise it would be fraudulent. If we all started making money, you know, we'd be sent to jail. The reason banks can do that is because they hold a banking license. It's a political decision whether they should hold a banking license. I know it's arm's length through the Financial Conduct Authority, but effectively the banking license is the politician's control over the banks.
But they're committing fraud even though they've got licenses.
Well, okay, but I mean that's a kind of technical matter. But I mean, if you don't hold a banking license and you try and create money, that's a criminal offence. But so that shows to you that actually politicians do decide who's a bank and who's not. And yet, for all these crises, they have never threatened to withdraw a banking license from anybody. Oh.
Martin,
that's
should
a, that's
should
a political
they?
Problem because the banking, the asset owning classes who control the banking system have been bailed out by the state and the politicians, but the politicians have not asserted their control
over. We've had a massive amount of money laundering going on at HSBC. But could the politicians actually withdraw HSBC's licence?
The political system's weaknesses then become clear. When Gordon Brown said to the City of London the week before the crash what a fantastic job they were all doing, there was no intention of regulating them and so on, he was not ready to deal with the crash the following week. He wasn't prepared. Now, my analysis of what's happening here, despite Molly's good intentions, is that there is going to be a major crash, probably linked with some geopolitical tensions around Ukraine or whatever, or even a small country like Greece defaulting. There's so many ways in which it could happen. And I hope that the civil servants in the Bank of England are aware of this, because the morning of the crash, I want to see a plan B to go. And if there isn't a plan B to go, then heads must roll.
Isn't Martin right, Molly? Maybe it is like a house of cards ready to collapse.
Well, I mean, you know, we're not talking about heads must roll. If the financial system collapses, we're talking about no money to buy food on the supermarket shelves. This is why in 2008 they waded into the markets to stop that happening, although they really seriously didn't want to. But at that point, when they took control of the banks, that was the point at which you could have said, well, you haven't done your job properly. So instead of letting you continue in the way, we'll either run you as a public bank or we'll set you up into a series of community banks, more like the German banking model. We could still do that. We still own RBS. One of the things we've proposed as the Green Party is don't sell that off and get the taxpayer a bit of money short term. Turn it into a system of community banks that actually lends to the real economy, so it's supporting the economy in the long run. I mean, these proposals are perfectly doable, because in that crisis, despite all their market rhetoric, they took control of not Barclays, but the rest of the big banks. But then they continue to let them operate at arm's length without actually running them in the public interest.
Bit naughty of them. Anyway, we had a bit of a referendum yesterday, didn't we? And the Scots had their first chance for 300 years to vote for independence, and it looks like 100%, no, not 100% turnout, but something like 90% 80, turnout.
85, I think.
Fantastic turnout, and there's a really engaged population, but they voted no. Molly, did they do the right thing, the Scots? The five and a quarter million, or 5 million roughly, that voted?
Well, it's obviously not for me to tell the Scots what to do, but I was supporting the Yes campaign, and the Scottish Greens, who are a separate party from us, were very much a part of that campaign.
Why the Yes?
Why the Yes? One of the things I believe very strongly is that part of the reason our politics is failing is because the nation states are just too large. People don't feel a connection with their politicians. And so Scotland, I think, would work better as a nation state because it's smaller, 5 million people. It would just be easier to get a sense of what your politicians are doing, to keep an eye on them, to actually meet with them. You know, we're so, even in the West Country here, we're so far away from what happens in Westminster. And so, yeah, so I think that's an important factor. But also I would have loved to see Scotland become independent, because I think it's got a very different view about what a good society's like. You know, I don't think they've ever bought into Thatcherism. They don't believe the market ideology. And it would have been so nice to have a country just on our border that was trying to work better for the common good. Also, that had a more plural system, so more parties represented. You know, they've got fairer electoral systems. It would just have been... And this is why I think the Westminster politicians were terrified of a Yes vote. It would just have shown us all that something better was possible.
Martin, the International Business Times is reporting today, Scotland independence referendum videos claim the vote is definitely a fix. Video showing pictures of one of the counts with a Yes vote in the No pile.
Yeah, well, I saw this earlier. I mean, I don't know whether this is enough to change the outcome. I'm afraid that Alex Salmond and the SNP and the Yes campaign have already decided to accept the result. So it's very... I mean, and certainly the Glasgow police are involved in personation going on in Glasgow, which is what used to happen in Northern Ireland all the time, the vote early, vote often syndrome. But I don't think it's actually going to change the result. I don't really... You know, maybe more will come out as we go forward. I would probably have voted yes had I been a Scot, but I think it's shaken the establishment to its core, despite the fact that the Yes vote did not succeed. I think that it shows the way politics should be in the future, with a more plural setup. I mean, what's clearly happening is that Scotland in particular, Wales and Northern Ireland are evolving politically as a result of having much more flexible political systems than the Westminster model. And the Westminster model, we could end up with a very perverse result after the next election in May 2015.
Alex Salmond has resigned an hour or so ago.
Oh dear, I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, you know, having lost, that's the honourable thing to do, and I'm surprised actually that with such a disastrous result in the local elections, the last local elections for the Lib Dems, that Nick Clegg didn't feel he wanted to resign. But to
carry on, I mean, I think we're not waiting for the next election. At least the Tories aren't waiting for the next election. They're immediately saying we're going to have an English Parliament. And what they mean by that is decisions about healthcare, social services, education, public spending generally in England will now be made excluding Scottish and Welsh MPs. And this means that the Tories basically have an inbuilt majority. Mm. So we're going to have even more neglect, I would argue, here in the southwest. But also, I don't think we share the same sort of southeast model of individualist, you know, out for yourself kind of capitalism. But that's going to be imposed on us through this English Parliament. And this is why, as Greens, we're saying, no, we don't want an English Parliament. We want regional parliaments. You know, let's do things better here in the southwest. And instead of me, you know, drawing a little plan or a map of where those should be, we're asking for a People's Constitutional Convention, a bit like they had in Scotland. You know, let's engage everybody in these discussions about how our democracy should
so
run.
Can you envisage a referendum on independence for the South West, Wessex as its own country?
Well, I think, like what happened in Scotland, you know, it's good to do it by degrees, because your local politicians have to get experience in dealing with these things they don't really know about at the moment. So Scotland is furthest ahead, Wales is next, but why not? I mean, maybe the South West as a whole is too large. We've certainly argued for an assembly for Cornwall, but you know, we could all sit down and draw our favourite maps on pieces of paper. I don't think Wessex extends very far west, actually, or historically Wessex didn't, but I mean, that would be the point of the constitutional convention. You'd see what areas made sense to people, because what's gone wrong always with local government reorganisation is somebody just sits down with a map and never talks to anybody, and the areas they draw don't make any sense.
This
so we don't
whole
want that.
Independence thing, Martin, though, it can be extremely contentious, can't it? I mean, Catalonia, for example, wants independence. Donetsk and Lugansk in eastern Ukraine want independence. How do you decide who's going to have independence, who's going to have a chance to vote for it, and who isn't?
Well, it's obviously extremely dependent upon historical factors and geopolitics and power politics. So, for example, as Putin's been saying about Crimea, the West insisted that Kosovo should be independent of Serbia, even though Kosovo was only an autonomous region within Serbia. It wasn't a full republic, as it had only been given autonomous region status in the early 70s as a result of local agitation in order to try and keep
so you're saying a handful of big power brokers decide, well, those well, guys are going to have a
now,
chance
what,
to
what
vote.
Happens is when NATO wanted to break up Yugoslavia, it was perfectly okay for Slovenia as well also to declare independence and start fighting with the Yugoslav National Army. They got the full support of NATO and the West in so doing. But when Crimea does it, it's a terrible thing, and we're going to go to war with Russia to stop it. But there's no consistency in any of this. The Indians won't accept independence or autonomy for Kashmir, but the Pakistanis won't accept it for Baluchistan, and so on and so forth. So what tends to happen is that big powers decide which little countries they're going to back in these squabbles, and there's no rational policy behind any of it. It's basically the strongest decides the policy.
Molly, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, that this is really what's got us into the problem in Iraq and Syria as well. Nobody's quite clear where the boundaries are. And I personally think the nation state is a sort of historical form that's past its sell-by date now. It was very much growing out of the age of empire and the age of imperialism in the 19th century. And it's just not making very much sense to people now, especially when the economy is globalised. People feel the sense for smaller areas which they can identify with. And interestingly, I went to Gibraltar during August, and that's a kind of self-governing territory of 30,000 people, so it's tiny by comparison with the areas we've been talking about.
Don't you represent Gibraltar?
I represent it, so it's part of my region, Southwest and Gibraltar. And so, you know, they make all decisions about how Gibraltar's going to be run, other than foreign policy. And, you know, I met the First Minister, they have elections, they have an interesting party structure. So, you know, if they can do it, why shouldn't we believe that smaller parts of our territory can make that work as well? It's an interesting prospect, but I think the risk is always about tensions between these areas. So you've got to be very aware of that as well. But this is a good thing about actually being in the European Union, you know, that I have colleagues there who are from Catalonia and from Slovenia and from all these countries. So when we discuss these issues there, we have some really wide range of experiences of what it's like to live in a small state, what it's like to be right next to a really big, powerful state like Russia. And so I think it helps us to think our way forwards in what the world's going to look like in the future, which may not be massive nation states.
Well, my assessment of why Alex Salmond and the Yes campaign lost is because they really failed to bite the bullet as to what was going to happen with the currency and the economy in Scotland. They were basically saying, well, we'll tell you after if we win what's going to happen. Molly, what do you think they should have done?
Well, I'll come to the currency in a minute, but I was in Glasgow last Thursday, and it was good to meet people who, all my mates were totally for yes, but I did also meet some people who were for no, and I think they were very, very fearful. I think it's easy to underestimate the power of the union in terms of people's identity. So one of the people I met had been a soldier, you know, and he said, well, I've fought for this union, and I want to continue
to be
part
of it. But there are Scottish regiments that could be, you know, just stay as Scottish regiments.
I know, but that's not how he saw it. He thought that he, you know, his mates had died for the United Kingdom, and it. So, you know, I think we have to get to understand that really strong identification that people in Scotland do have with the union. So, part of it was about that, but I think part of it was just that people couldn't be sure about where anything was going, because that could only be decided in a negotiation after a yes vote. So, in a sense, what could the Scottish Nationalists and the Greens and all those other people say? Because they didn't know what was going to come out of the negotiation, so there was always going to be risk and uncertainty.
Okay,
and in the end,
what do you think they should have been pushing for in terms of a currency?
In terms of a currency, well, the Scottish Green Party argued that Scotland should have its own currency. I mean, to have a successful currency, people have to accept it. It has to be backed by something of value. It has to have credibility.
I mean, is the pound or the euro, are they backed by something of value?
Well, they are backed by the economy.
Aren't they just faith-based currencies?
Yes, but if you were going to take a currency, you would look at the country that was standing behind that currency. I think in the case of Scotland, they've got oil, they've got skillful population, they've got good land. I think that Scotland could make a successful currency
they've
that had nothing to do with the banking.
Exactly.
Resources. So that's what backs up your currency. So this is what the Greens were arguing. You know, forget arguing with Osborne about the pound. Let's just make our own currency. Then we have all the benefits of creating that currency and feed that into our economy. So we proposed that. But I think Salmond was worried about that because he just didn't think people would believe that Scotland had the credibility to run its own currency.
Martin, did they?
Well, I think it's partly to do with credibility, and it's partly to do with the fact that there was an awful lot of opposition. You've got to take people a long way for them to get to accept that kind of policy.
Exactly.
Although, looking across the sea to Norway, you've got an obvious model. They've got the Norwegian krona there, which they've managed very successfully. And of course, their sovereign wealth fund, they made sure that they didn't invest it inside Norway, so that they kept the currency low, and they invested it outside Norway, so they didn't get what they call the Dutch disease, where the currency rises in value and chokes off.
I mean,
your
Orkney and Shetland actually used to be part of Scandinavia, didn't they? Part of Denmark, you know, so you would think that there was a natural wish for the Scots to say, well, actually, maybe we would do better as a kind of Scandinavian country.
Well, they have sort of said that, but they're a bit troubled, you know, because they have bought into the neoliberal ideology too much, I think. You know, they are basically going on with market capitalism, and they maybe do that a bit to distance themselves from Scottish socialists, I don't know, but I think they've lost their way slightly on economic policy, and because of that, they then fell into the traps that the London politicians were setting for them, and in the end people just didn't believe them.
Okay, well, let's look at some of the week's other stories. Leading climate scientists in yesterday's Independent call on religious leaders to help save the environment. This is Tom Borden writing the Independent. Two of the world's leading scientists have made an unprecedented call on religious leaders to spark a massive mobilisation of public opinion, insisting that only through God can we save the environment. Writing in the journal Science, Cambridge University's Partha Dasgupta and Veerbhabhan Ramathan of the University of California made an impassioned plea for help in curbing potentially catastrophic effects of what they call the ongoing abuse of the planet's natural resources, arguing that humans' relationship with nature is at a crossroads. They say unsustainable consumption, population pressure, poverty and environmental degradation are intricately linked, but this is appreciated neither by development economists nor by national governments who permit GDP growth to trump environmental protection of their policies. Molly, what do you make of that?
Well, there's quite a lot there, isn't there? I do agree that economics is the problem here, and this is part of the reason I became an economist, because...
You mean the problem, causing environmental problems, because that's what this is really about.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the the sort of market, not the market ideology, the neoliberal ideology or the neoclassical understanding of economics does suggest that you can always have growth within a finite planet. You know, it kind of, they always make that joke, don't they, that economists will just assume anything away. You know, how many economists it take to change a light bulb, they just assume it's changed. And the economics, I'm afraid, is like that. So they just assume you can have infinite growth within a finite planet when anybody you meet on the bus can tell you that's just impossible. And so that kind of misunderstanding of economics is the reason, I think, why we're putting extraordinary pressure on the planet in terms of climate change, but also loss of habitat, loss of species, you know, all sorts of other pollution problems. So, yeah, I mean,
do you think scientists
really
should be getting engaged in these kind of moral questions like this? Or should they just be doing experiments
and keep quiet
on these sorts of issues?
I do think it's a bit odd that, you know, we've reached a desperate stage, haven't we, where scientists are calling on God to save us. I mean, we've really got to do a little bit better than that. But
they're calling on religious leaders. That's basically
That's more useful. But I do think that it's a problem that politicians often hide behind scientists. I mean, the difficult decisions here are political decisions. For example, if we say we've got to keep the economy within a certain boundary, then that means we've all got to consume less. I mean, the Green Party does tell people that, but other politicians are just frightened of selling that as a political message. Although, actually, I think the levels of consumption we have in this country aren't increasing our happiness anymore. You know, it's almost exhausting having to go shopping for the latest gadget all the time, and the hours we have to work to make the money to do that. It's like some appalling treadmill that keeps the capitalist economy going and doesn't actually make us any happier. So, you know, we have to make that argument, but I think mainstream politicians are just afraid to do that. So they're the problem, really. It's a political problem. The scientists have told us what's going on. The politicians need to make the right decisions.
Martin, have we become growth junkies, as they're suggesting, these religious people here and scientists?
I think the problem is that a capitalist economy based upon capital accumulation has to grow. It just does, or it doesn't work.
If it collapses,
and then you have world wars. I mean, that's what's happened twice in the last century. So, in other words, when the politicians say we've got to keep, I mean, the Chinese Communist Party, for example, the growth is going down in China. They fear they will lose power if growth is not maintained. So, it's not just the kind of that people are hooked on consumerism. It's also that the kind of capitalist economy we have relies upon increasing growth. And I don't think. I believe in an entirely steady state economy. What I believe is that you can continue to have growth, but it's got to be of a completely different kind. So that you, for example, the resource intensity of that growth is completely different. So that we're creating a weightless economy that does all sorts of things that we do now, so that our standard of living and happiness is not affected, but we've got a different technology which is much, much more energy efficient. And I think there's overlap between that and the idea of a limit.
I agree with you that it's a structural problem with capitalism, that it has to have growth. And consumerism is there to, you know, to almost force us to buy the stuff so that growth can continue. But I think it's quite difficult to think about this weightless economy, because if you think about what you can do that actually doesn't use energy and resources, there is really hardly anything at all. So obviously we need to focus more on the way we use resources. We need to use them more efficiently, and we need to focus particularly on the energy efficiency of our economy. But I think that's limited. You know, we do also have to just consume less, just reduce the amount of materials stuff we've got around us, just end built-in obsolescence, just stop travelling around so much, especially
flying. Yeah, but
you're
not going to do that with the corporations in charge. Anyway, one corporation which is in the news today is GlaxoSmithKline, who have been told they've got to pay £300 million roughly, fine over the China bribery network. Mark Riley and executives from GlaxoSmithKline face up to 4 years in jail over claims that their sales team bribed doctors to prescribe company medicine. This is Nick Fletcher in The Guardian today. GlaxoSmithKline has been found guilty of bribery. Martin?
Well, I mean, this is more grist to the mill, isn't it, of the way the real world really works as opposed to the textbooks.
I mean, and what has this got to do anything at all with geopolitics? Because it might possibly be that GlaxoSmithKline have been
It's more than likely that there's some political reasons why they've been singled out to be punished in China as opposed to somebody else.
My other question is, I wonder whether they're doing that here in Britain and in Europe, but without being prosecuted.
Let's make the socialist. I would argue as a socialist that all production of medicines, which is basically what they do, should be produced on a not-for-profit minute basis.
I agree.
It's totally absurd. I mean, the real expense of the National Health Service is the money that's handed over as tribute to the pharmaceutical companies year on year.
And this is what we learned from
year.
The Ebola crisis, isn't it? Because why is there not a vaccine for Ebola? Because scientific research into pharmaceuticals is driven by profit rather than need. And because poor people have tended to suffer from Ebola, it's just been left. I mean, it could, you know, 30 years we've known about Ebola. We could have had a vaccine 20 years ago and we wouldn't have seen these thousands of people dying. Mm. And they will invent a vaccine now. And the reason is rich people are going to start dying if it doesn't get contained pretty soon. So that tells you what's wrong with the pharmaceutical
industry. But my point here is that, I've heard from doctors specifically that they are actually, there's a financial incentive for them to use particular types of drugs in this country. Mm. What they're saying in China is we're not having it.
Well, what I like about this story particularly is that, you know, you hear so many, when people say, oh, it's, you know, poor economy in Africa, they always blame corruption and bribery of politicians. But what they don't say is that for every, you know, there's another side to every bribe. And here we're seeing the other side. Mm. So here's GlaxoSmithKline. Okay, the Chinese politicians took the bribe, but GlaxoSmithKline offered the bribe. And every time you hear somebody saying, oh, look at the corruption in Africa, somebody's offering that money, and it's usually, you know, an oil corporation or somebody like that. So here at least we're seeing that exposed.
Okay. Go on.
Transparency International has this league table, and of course, you know, countries are in Africa at the top head of it. But of course, who is bribing these people?
Exactly.
It's the biggest bribery, the biggest source of bribery probably in the world is in the City of London, right here at home.
Okay, well, with mentioning health, let's go to Prime Minister's questions. It wasn't this week, because there wasn't one. But last week, and it wasn't really the Prime Minister, it was William Hague in the chair answering the questions, because I think the party leaders were all up in Scotland campaigning away. And this is a question from Clive Betts about the National Health Service. He's heard that the 25% cut is coming in the National Health Service, which is supposed to be safe in the Coalition's hands.
Mr. Clive Betts.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Last Thursday, I attended a public meeting of Beighton in my constituency, where the doctors in the Beighton and Southall practice were consulting their patients about how they were going to deal with a budgetary cut of 22 to 24% by the year 2018. This cut of 22 to 24% has officially been notified to them by NHS England. Will the Leader of the House confirm that if the Conservatives are in power after the general election, these are the cuts that my constituents can expect?
Well, I can confirm that this government has raised the NHS budget in line with inflation, which his party was not committed to do at the last general election. And, of course, I know the Secretary of State for Health will want to discuss with him the details of the local situation, but I hope he did explain to them that overall, since the last election, the number of nurses is up 3,700, the number of doctors is up 6,500, the number of people who say they're treated with dignity and respect is up 10%, and we've now been ranked as the top health system in the world according to the Commonwealth Fund, moving from 7th in the world 4 years ago.
Yeah. Well, this is the government that promised no top-down reorganisation of the health service, and then in defiance of their own manifesto decided to bring in further marketisation of the health service and allowing any provider to bid for contracts, which of course opens you up to things under TTIP. This is the real problem with TTIP, is that what the Tories have done is they've allowed the National Health Service to be potentially suable under TTIP if they don't take bids from, for example, US companies. So in all of these feel-good statistics are simply window dressing, because the real problem is that the system has been set up to be broken up completely.
Molly, pretty shocking there to hear that these doctors, just having been put in charge of these big health budgets, are being told, well, sorry guys, 23% cuts coming.
Yeah, well, I think going back to what we were saying about pharmaceutical companies, we really need to rethink the way our health system works, because it is very much growth focused at the moment. It's sort of, you know, demand led and growth focused, whereas actually a lot of the treatments that people have are not are not doing much in terms of their well-being. I mean, what people want is to be well looked after, to be properly cared for. But what we're seeing is labour cut, so fewer nurses, not looking after people very well, but more and more machines and drugs. And I think, you know, I don't think that's serving our interests. And perhaps what we need is also kind of like a patient's commission on health, actually asking people which treatments they want and what type of care they want, because I don't think they would go for this growth-driven model, which actually suits corporate profits rather than personal care.
Harriet Harman The deputy leader of the Labour Party was sitting in Ed Miliband's boots, asking the questions at, well, I don't know about boots, but shoes, possibly, asking the questions. That was last week at Prime Minister's Questions. And she was interested to wondering where maybe there was going to be more devolution, not just Scotland.
As we set about devolving further powers to Scotland, does he agree that the time has also come to devolve further power to Wales and, crucially, to the great cities and regions of England too?
The decision next week, of course, as we all know, is a matter for the people of Scotland, but the implications will be felt by all the people of the United Kingdom. We are already steadily devolving increased power to parts of England, as well as have been doing so in Wales. Under this government, Wales has received more primary lawmaking powers. We're moving towards devolving tax and borrowing powers for the first time. And we want to see devolution in Northern Ireland succeed. In England, the Localism Act devolves power of business rates to local authorities, and city deals have given local areas more of a say over their governance. The great strength of the United Kingdom is that it is not a rigid union. It is a living, flexible union, and that is one of its greatest strengths of all.
Yeah, so I think the worrying thing here is this emphasis on devolution of power to the great cities, brackets, and regions. I mean, I represent an area here, a lot of which is rural, and I could see the rural areas really being neglected if the focus is on cities. And my other worry about it is that when the regional development authorities were abolished, the government set up a series of things called local enterprise partnerships, LEPs, and these actually now give out public money, but they're run by businessmen, in fact. And this is where I see this going in terms of this devolution. What they'll do is they'll allow non-accountable bodies to administer public money. So I think we have to insist on regional assemblies so we can actually elect people to decide how our money is spent.
Another problem with these LEPs, local enterprise partnerships, is secrecy. They're basically run like a company, a business, and there's no real public scrutiny. You're not allowed to sit at one of the LEP meetings as you would be at a council meeting. So there's a lot of difference, isn't there? Martin, what are your thoughts about the idea of further devolution? Other sorts of devolution.
Well, it can be used as a neoliberal trick to break down standards. So it's not always positive. I mean, personally, I think that if we had a federal United Kingdom with a strong central, which we used to have, I mean, people used to think of the national government as being more competent, and they had a lot more faith in it than they did in local government, possibly because they saw more of local government. And I'm in favour of devolution. I'm in favour of subsidiarity. You should make local decisions at the level where it's appropriate, but we also need coordination. If we're going to stop corporate takeover at the level of the EU, we're going to need EU-wide political parties and movements to do that.
I basically agree about subsidiarity, which is obviously a European word, and we did have the rather unfortunate slogan, making subsidiarity happen, as part of our election agenda. I do think people often think about politics as being hierarchical. So people who write to me now will say, you know, oh, there's a planning decision and I've written to my MP and they didn't give me any satisfaction, so now I'm coming to you in Europe. But that's not how it works. It works that different powers are exercised at different levels. So, for example, climate change, there's not much point in having carbon emissions if you just cut them in Herefordshire, you know, so it makes sense to do that globally or at the moment at the European level. But other things like, you know, weights and measures, that would be perfectly happily done in the West Country if it wanted to go back to some kind of medieval weights and measure. Who cares? So, you know, I think it's a question of getting the right power exercised at the right level. And at the moment, the worst problem we've got is the massive domination by Westminster and that close tie to the city and to finance, which is really throttling all the regional economies, which could be thriving, including here in the West Country.
Well, one of the big problems, of course, is people are just getting less and less time to spend with their kids, etc., and less money in comparison to what they're having to spend. This is a so-called cost of living crisis, and that was a point and a question which was made by Gareth Thomas at Prime Minister's Questions last week.
Mr. Gareth Thomas.
Yeah. In 2012, the Prime Minister said that he wanted to see economic growth that meant rising living standards for all. Can the Leader of the House tell us then why Britain has seen one of the largest falls in real wages of any EU country, beaten only by Cyprus, Portugal and Greece?
recession?
Well, he might remember that there was a debt-fueled deep recession that came about under the previous government. And of course, that has to be paid for. But after 4 years now of the disciplined policies of my right honourable friend, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, we now have the fastest growth of the G7 economies. We have employment nearing a record high. We have nearly 2 million new apprenticeships who started in this time. This is a remarkable economic turnaround from a catastrophic situation we were left.
So this is the big lie that sits behind the politics of austerity, which is to say that we ended up with massive debts because of overspending by Labour. In fact, the data clearly show that the reason we've got massive debts is because money was poured into the banks, as we were discussing earlier, to stop the financial system collapsing. And in terms of wages, I mean, this is the other point about your economy ceasing to grow. If your economy doesn't grow, then there isn't so. Then the amount you've got to share out is the same, so people cannot have increasing wages if capital is still demanding an increasing share, as it is. So this is why wages are not increasing. And while we allow the owners of capital and the shareholders and so on to maintain power in the economy, then they can ensure that they gain any extra value rather than it going in wages.
Well, that's absolutely correct. And of course, ultimately, we were talking about if you're going to have a more non-growth-oriented economy, there's got to be massive redistribution of wealth. And don't forget that all the people who own assets, if we had followed a von Mises free market policy and allowed the banks to collapse, they would have lost everything. So when we come along and say we want 10% or even 50% of what you've got, you should think yourself.
Can I just come in? Because we sometimes lose the amount of money which was given to the bank. Well, not given, lent, I suppose, to the banks. The bailout was... Anyone, either of you, like to guess how much it was in the UK?
Well, it's quite difficult to quantify. I mean, 1.4 trillion is the closest figure I've
Okay, well,
found.
This is... which is... That's the national debt, roughly. Friday the 4th of December 2009, Andrew Grice, the Independent Political Editor, £850 billion, the official cost of the bank bailout, and still RBS is demanding more in bonuses. So that's basically where we're at. Anyway, let's go on to a local story. We ought to do a local story at some point, didn't we? Not a very nice one, though, I'm afraid. And it's the former Western Super Mayor Philip Judd has been jailed for downloading indecent pictures of children. This is in the Western Daily Press on the 15th, a few days ago. Former mayor was jailed yesterday after he admitted downloading more than 350 indecent pictures and videos of children because, he said, he was curious. Shamed Philip Judd, 60 years old, stored sickening images showing children as young as three being abused after deliberately seeking them out on a notorious sharing website. A court heard that Judd was a married father of three with a lifetime of public service that covered a dark secret. He had been a local councillor since 2007 and was mayor of Weston-super-Mare in Somerset between 2010 and 2011. He was also appointed vice chair of North Somerset Council in May 2013. Police had found a total of 205 images and 156 films stored on his computer. Martin, he's pleaded guilty to 12 charges and jailed for 14 months a few days ago by Judge Mark Horton.
Well, it's obviously a very disturbing story.
It's rather worrying. What amazes me is that people like this can sort of hide, almost like a kind of Jimmy Savile-style character, right in the face of the public. And that almost seems to be the best place for someone who is of that mind to be.
Well, the real problem with the Savile story and all the rest of it is that paedophilia is of great interest to intelligence services of various kinds, and it's used for political blackmail. And that's why you find that hence the worry about this elite paedophile group connected to the Thatcher government.
The other aspect that bothers me about this particularly, Molly, is that nowhere in the reporting over the last couple of months have they mentioned that he's a Tory councillor. The word Tory, Conservative, is completely missing from these reports.
Well, that's interesting, but the sort of scandals that you feel are still swirling around Westminster suggest that this might not be unique to the Conservative Party. And I do feel that there are concerns here around power and the abuse of vulnerable children, particularly children in care, and I don't really feel we've got to the bottom of this. I know that things happened in the North Wales child abuse scandal, which really suggested that there were relationships between people in power and those who were organising the abuse, and I don't know about this case at all, but I do feel that there are unsavoury details like that which are still not really coming out into the open.
the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland was used by MI5 as a honey trap to trap loyalist paramilitary activists. And it was, Ken Livingstone made his maiden speech to the Commons about it. It's still a live story in Northern Ireland. Peter Robinson was talking about it the other day. So in other words, MI5 have definitely been the frame for using paedophilia in order to blackmail political opponents.
Yeah, on the national scene, we've got Theresa May setting up two child abuse inquiries, and the latest one also looks as if it's been stillborn, the one that Lady Butler Schloss was removed from because her brother had been Attorney General at the time of many of these abuse allegations.
Not
in
being prosecuted.
Whitehall.
Hmm.
Yes, and the latest person is someone called Fiona Wolfe, who apparently has very close ties to Leon Britton, who's another person. Mm. So it doesn't seem as if Theresa May is seriously going to deal with this. Anyway, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for in the first hour.
From the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, Alex Salmond will step down as Scotland's First Minister in November after narrowly missing out on his dream of independence. 45% of Scottish voters agreed with him and said yes to breaking away from the UK, but it wasn't enough. He says the role's been the privilege of his life, and although his time as leader is nearly over, Scotland's campaign continues.
The position is this: we lost the referendum vote, but Scotland can still carry the political initiative. Scotland can still emerge as the real winner.
We should find out in a matter of weeks what extra powers Westminster is likely to hand over to Scotland. Police investigating the disappearance of a 14-year-old schoolgirl are searching a second property in West London. Scotland Yard says detectives are at a house in Hanwell. Officers have also found a bike belonging to Latvian builder Arne Salkins, who they named yesterday as a suspect in Alice Gross's disappearance. Rotherham Council's Director of Children's Services, Joyce Thacker, has resigned following the Rotherham child sex abuse scandal. The authority says she's leaving by mutual agreement with immediate effect. She's been under pressure to step down after a report last month revealed 1,400 children were abused in the town. The final and semi-finals of Euro 2020 will be held at Wembley Stadium. It'll end at 24...